Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to continue our celebration of our four-year anniversary. As I said last week, I had over 200 shows to go through and try and pick out some of my favorite shows, some clips from my favorite shows. So we've got part two this week, and we'll probably have a part three next week because I had a lot more left that I couldn't fit into this show. So on this episode of the four-year anniversary, we're going to hear from Corey Everson and Tony Pearson and Phil Williams. We're also going to hear from Charlotte Parker, who was Arnold's agent during his prime Hollywood years. We're going to hear from Barbara Outland, who was Arnold's first girlfriend and wrote a book about him called Arnold and Me. Jack Neary, one of my favorite interviews of the last year. He was, of course, one of the writers for Muscle Builder magazine. Dave McVeigh, who was the editor of the film Raw Iron, which was a documentary about pumping iron, which they released in 2002. So I got an interview with Dave. I thought that was very interesting. We're also going to have clips from our Ed Connors interview. Now, I talked to Ed several times. This was the first interview I did with him. And also John Little, and this was the John Little interview from last year, not the one we just recently did. And John talked about Mike Mentzer and also Bruce Lee. So we got all that coming up for you in a minute. And then after our anniversary show, I am going to read another article. I hope you guys are enjoying these articles. I love them. This is another old muscle builder from 1978. And since we're talking so much about Arnold on this podcast, I thought I would read an article about Arnold. And it was written by Rick Wayne, another guy we've been trying to get on the show for years. And keep your fingers crossed. Hopefully, guys, one day it'll happen. This article is called Another Gold-Crusted Mr. Olympia. And it was written right after the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest that Arnold promoted with Jim Warmer. And I believe Arnold was also featured on an episode of 60 Minutes. And this was right after that, too. So it's an interesting article by Rick Wayne. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so what's going on in your world, guys? Before we get to our second part of our four-year anniversary, I do want to mention some bad news. Jenny Lynn Powell, who went by the name Jenny Lynn when she was competing, Jenny was a figure competitor, and she did very well. I think she won the Arnold, and I know she won the figure Olympia twice. I believe it was in 2007, 2008, and she beat out Monica Brandt, had a great physique. I remember when I worked for Iron Man magazine, Jenny did a lot of photo shoots for Iron Man. She was on the cover several times. Anyways, Jenny passed away over the weekend, and she was only, I think, 48 years old. From what I read, from what Lonnie Tieper posted on Facebook, I guess Jenny had a seizure in the middle of the night. And her husband tried to save her, and he wasn't able to. And Jenny passed away at 48 years old. This is terrible news. So young, and she was a great person. I think I met her a couple times at the Arnold Classic. Didn't really know her. But to die that young, it's just amazing. I'll tell you, with the social media and Facebook, it seems like every week I'm hearing about somebody die, and I guess it's just because we're aware of it now because of social media, but man, it's just unbelievable how many people are passing away so fast, and some of them are so young. There was another guy from Florida. His name was Brian DeGaglia. You probably never heard of him out there in the real world, but Brian was a good competitor out here in Florida. Before I started this Bodybuilding Legends podcast, I ran a website called Florida Physique where I was going around to all the shows in Florida. Every weekend I was traveling to a show, and I was trying to get coverage for all these local competitors because we had some really great competitors out here in Florida. And there was a show literally every single week in Florida. It was amazing. When I lived in Chicago, we had maybe 8 shows a year. Out here, they have, I don't even know how many, because they had 3 districts in Florida. They have the Panhandle District, which is way up north. And then they had the Central District, which is where I live, like Orlando, Tampa area. And then they had the Southern District, which was Miami, Fort Lauderdale area. So sometimes you would have 3 shows in one weekend. So when I first moved here to Florida in 2010, I started going to some contests and I noticed that nobody was doing any kind of coverage. So I came up with this idea of starting a website called Florida Physique. And as I said, every weekend I would travel. So I got to see Brian DeGaglia compete a few times. He was a master's competitor, about 40 years old, and had a great physique, kind of a short guy, but really thick and really ripped. And a really good physique and a really nice guy. I interviewed him several times. And apparently he passed away over the weekend. I read on Facebook a couple of weeks ago that he had cancer and now he is gone. He was like 45 years old. So unbelievable. So rest in peace, Jenny Lynn and Brian DeGaglia. Gone way, way too soon. Unbelievable. Both bodybuilders in their 40s. Also, continuing with the bad news, Bill Phillips, who was the owner of Muscle Media 2000, and he ran the supplement company EAS. I guess apparently he caught COVID, and this was the second time he caught it. And I saw this on his Facebook page. He is now in the hospital. He's caught COVID again for the second time, and he's on a ventilator. So he is in really bad shape. Hopefully he can pull through. But I guess he did not get vaccinated. I guess he thought after having COVID the first time, he would have the antibodies, and then he would not get it again. But here's a guy who is definitely still works out in good shape. Probably thought he had a good immune system, and somehow, some way, he got it again. And this time it really hit him hard. So we hope he comes back from that. I guess he's doing a little bit better. His wife is posting notices on Facebook. So hopefully Bill will get better. All right. I do want to mention again my online seminar, which is scheduled for July 31st. And it will run from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And the topic is building muscle over 40. So this will be an online seminar. It will be live. And you can just go to my website, johnhansonfitness.com, and you can sign up for it there. So, yeah, I hope we get a lot of people interested in that. If you do not make it or you cannot make it for the July 31st, it will be taped. And it will be up there for later viewing if you want to do it that way. So this is the first time I'm doing an online seminar. I've never done this before. I saw Dave Palumbo has been doing his How to Be a Contest Guru seminars online. So I contacted the same people that do his seminars, and I'm going to give it a shot and see if it works out. In the future, I'd like to do one also on bodybuilding history. When I talked to these guys who run these seminars, they said a lot of their people who do seminars, they do them over several weeks, kind of like a classroom setting where they'll teach a class for like 6 weeks or 8 weeks. So I think that would be great to do bodybuilding history, just start at the very beginning with the Eugene Sandow years and go all through the major events in bodybuilding over the decades. So hopefully I can put that together one day and give that a try. I'm sure all of our listeners here at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast would be interested in that, since you guys are interested in the history of the sport. All right. I did not get any emails last week from the anniversary show. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I did get 2 emails. Let me check those out. I don't think they were about the anniversary show, but I'll read them. Jim Kerr, who is one of our Patreon sponsors. So thank you, Jim, for supporting the show. If anyone out there is interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor, you can go to the bodybuildinglegendsshow.com website, which is our official website for the podcast. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the Patreon link. So if you wanted to do that, I appreciate you guys who support the show. Jim says, hey, John, great job with the interview with Roy Callender and Lee Haney. It's nice to hear that Roy is doing so well. I believe that he was one of the most underrated bodybuilders of his era. I agree with that. He says, Haney has always struck me as a very perceptive guy, and this interview reinforced that belief. His comments about modern bodybuilders training like powerlifters really sounded correct to me. When you gain so much weight in the off season and train heavy and infrequently, it's almost impossible to bring in an aesthetic look at contest time. Jim Kerr. And then I got another email here. It says, "Hey, John, I really have enjoyed your past few shows. The John Little interview was terrific with great insight on a side of Mike Mentzer most of us never saw. Roy Callender and Lee Haney were a lot of fun to listen to, and their genuine friendship was clearly evident on the show. A couple of suggestions for future guests. Mr. International Joe Nazario is active on Facebook, as is UK legend Walter O'Malley, whom Boyer Coe mentioned in his interview. Also, Pete Kromkowski would be a great guest, both as a competitor and for his involvement with Gold's Gym. Thank you for all that you do, Rich Fitter." All right, thank you, Rich. Yeah, I believe I'm friends with Joe Nazario, so I'll reach out to him. And Walter O'Malley, I've tried contacting him a few times on Facebook, and he never responded, but I could try again. And Pete Kromkowski, I have no way to get a hold of him, but maybe Ed Connors would know, so I could try that. So thank you for you guys who emailed me this week. If anyone out there wants to email me, you can do it at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll read your email on the air. All right. Well, we got a big show coming up here, guys, so I won't take up your time. Here we go with our second part of our four-year anniversary for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, here we go. All right, we're going to start off with one of my favorite guests from last year, from 2020. This was Corey Everson, six-time Miss Olympia, and definitely one of the most influential and iconic women bodybuilders in the sport. It was a joy to interview Corey. She was such a pleasant person, such a great person. So in this first segment that we're going to listen to, Corey talks about the blood clot that affected her earlier in her career and also her favorite contest that she ever competed in. Here we go. How many couple shows did you guys do?
I'm not sure exactly, but it was at least, you know, somewhere between seven.
Wow.
It was whichever okay. ones there were, we were in. And then the one that is the best contest I've ever been in my entire life, I looked the worst that I've ever looked in my entire life. But it meant so much to me because I had had a blood clot and they almost amputated my leg. And it was 1980, I don't remember when, it was maybe 1980 or 1982. I think it was 1982. And I had this blood clot in my leg and I didn't know what it was. And it turns out I have a blood clotting disorder that is passed down from my mom's side of the family. And it's hereditary. And it's also very prevalent in Germans, which I'm 100% German. And so Jeff and I were supposed to compete in a contest that weekend. And I was in Chicago working as an interior designer. And we were going to do couples. And I was put into the hospital. And I was in the hospital for, was in intensive care for 10 weeks. I was in critical care for another four. And then I had to learn to walk again. And Jeff was at my side every night, and even though they weren't allowed in the intensive care unit, he stayed there anyways and just sat, and he was studying for his doctorate degree. And so he would sit there in this hard wooden chair on my right side. I still can see it. And he would study. He'd be studying chemical balancing formulas and all this stuff. And then I was laying there with IVs in my arms and my leg elevated, and the doctor absolutely stumped, not knowing what the heck was going on. I'm a young athlete. Why do I have a blood clot? You know, that's for old people who are sedentary. And they didn't even have the testing done back then for the blood clotting disorder. It wasn't even developed yet. And the doctor, you know, the very primitive internets that they had back then, the doctor saw that there was some girl in Iceland who had a similar thing. And because of the studies he did with the girl in Iceland who had the same thing, they put me on this medicine called streptokinase, which is like Drano, and it eats away clotting in your vessels, and you know, which is very dangerous because it could, you could have an aneurysm or internal bleeding and all this other stuff. But anyway, so the, you know, after I learned how to walk again, and the doctor said I would never be able to compete again, and I probably wouldn't be able to walk normally because the inside of my leg was scarred up, we competed in the national championships in Las Vegas, and I looked like crap, and I was so skinny, and I lost all my muscle, and I was so thin, but we competed, and we won it, and not only
did
we win
it,
yeah, I didn't add anything at all to the win, but Jeff looked amazing. And I happened to, you know, what the emphasis really wasn't on how muscular the women were anyway, but,
right.
You know, our victory there was, oh my gosh, we proved the doctors wrong and we competed and we won and I'm alive and my leg wasn't amputated. And
jeez.
It was like the victory of life. And
right.
That is why that is my favorite contest. You know, people say, which Miss Olympia was your favorite contest? Well, actually it was that contest that we won the couples championships because of that victory.
Right, right. So when you were in the hospital, they were going to amputate your leg because they didn't know what to do.
They didn't know what to do. And unless I started to get blood flow, they were worried about, because the clot was in my iliac, femoral, and popliteal veins. So from my hip to my toes, it was totally clotted.
Wow.
And my leg was like Tom Platz's leg. I mean, it was so swollen and it was so painful. And what happens is your secondary capillarization starts to take over for the veins that aren't functioning, and my secondary capillarization became my primary capillarization. And so because I was in such good shape, my other veins took over for the deep veins, and so my leg was spared. So thank God for that.
Yeah, I remember the story about having a blood clot in your leg, but I didn't know it was that involved. I didn't know they were going to amputate it.
Oh God, it was so bad. I mean, and it's actually now they have the testing done where they do protein C deficiency and protein S deficiency and factor V laden, which is all blood clotting disorders. And you can actually have that disorder and never even experience a blood clot. But, you know, if you have two of them, then it exacerbates the chances that you will have it. And I happen to have two of those blood clotting disorders. And again, it's more common in Germans than any other nationality.
Right. All right. And in this clip from Corey talks about her decision to retire from bodybuilding and her perception that women's bodybuilding was changing, that the women were getting more and more muscular. Here we go.
And who was it the next year?
The last year in 89 was Sandy Rydell.
Oh, yeah. And that's when I quit. Yeah. I saw that I couldn't keep up anymore. You know, it was like my body wasn't changing anymore. And I was still the same lean 145, 147 pound athlete. And,
right.
You know, and she was so much more muscular than me. And I was like, okay, I don't want to ever lose. You know, this is kind of cool having a winning streak. And it's time for me to go. And I think I was 30 or 32 or something. And I was starting to think, okay, you know, you got to start thinking about kids. And, you know, after 35, it's going to be harder to have a baby. And, you know, I just think I think a couple of things. A, I don't think I could have kept up with that kind of muscularity. And B, I was, I think I was burnt out. Without me knowing it, I think I was burnt out.
I can believe it with that schedule you had. I mean, you were training so much and guest posing every weekend and doing seminars and then competing every year and winning every year. So I can understand.
It was a lot. And then we had other businesses we were doing with Samson and Delilah and photo shoots and seminars and, you know, appearances on TV and doing our show. And it was, you know, again, I think I made it look like it might've been easy because I smile a lot. But maybe, but under that smile, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm burnt out.
Yeah.
So
did you see the sport starting to change? Because we know, obviously, the women bodybuilders got much, much bigger after the 1980s. So did you see that trend starting to change?
Change immediately. Like that year that I quit, it was, you know, the next year. Who won the next year? Was it Linda?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. And she would have kicked my butt on stage. I mean, the trend had changed and she had beautiful shape and symmetry, but she was bigger than me. And so it was, it would be like me against Mary Roberts. Well, it would have been Linda against me, you know? And I just saw that when I exited, I did a complete exit. Like I didn't really follow the sport and I didn't, you know, I just was like, okay, now I get to live life a little bit and experience, you know, life a little bit without having to be perfect, you know? And so I don't think I went to the gym all the time, even though I was in shape, you know, I stayed in good shape. But I started playing tennis and doing some other, you know, skiing and water skiing and snow skiing and do some things mm-hmm. that I really had never been able to do.
Yeah. On this show, we do obviously called Bodybuilding Legends. So we talk about most of the shows are the bodybuilders from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it seems like there's so many people that love that look of the bodybuilders. And I think you could say the same about the women bodybuilders. If you look at the women bodybuilders in the 1980s, they were very beautiful. They were had some muscle, but not too muscular. They definitely looked like beautiful women, and they had great posing routines. And I think that's why that look and that era was so popular.
It was such, I call it the golden era. I'm sure everybody calls the era they were in the golden era.
right.
You know, but to me, it was so special, and it was entertaining to go to a bodybuilding contest, even if you didn't want to be a bodybuilder, because the routines were so beautiful.
Yeah, did you know your retirement, Corey? Or did you know in advance before that 89 Olympia that was going to be your last year, or did you decide afterwards?
I think we kind of decided after. Jeff and I discussed it, and we were discussing like slowing down and not having to guest pose so much, and you know, because I think he was seeing that it was just really draining me. But I don't think we really announced it until sometime after that we wanted to be sure that we were really done with it.
Yeah. When you look at your career now, it looks like it was perfect because you got into bodybuilding at the beginning of the 1980s and then you got out in 1989, right at the end of the decade.
I know. It was perfect. It really was. And I think anytime you get into a sport in the beginning of it, like Jan Todd, who is a power lifter, and she was a world record holder and, you know, really launched powerlifting into the women's field. She got into it early too, you know, when it was first starting. And and she's a legend. And so I think, fortunate for me, I got into it early. And if I didn't get into it early, I wouldn't be Miss Olympia.
All right. And this clip is from another really fun interview I did, I believe, earlier this year. This was Tony Pearson and Phil Williams. And what Tony and Phil had in common was when they were younger, when they were teenagers, they trained at George Turner's gym in St. Louis, Missouri. And then Tony eventually moved to California, and Phil, of course, went on, and he also moved to California and then Sweden. But Phil went on to win the 1985 MPC Nationals, and then he won his first pro show, which was the 1988 Chicago Pro. And Tony went on to win the 1978 Mr. America contest at only 21 years old. Then he competed in NABBA and he won the Mr. Universe over there. And then eventually he had a great career as a pro bodybuilder with the IFBB. Tony won a lot of mixed pairs competitions and he was a top competitor and a great popular competitor. So in this clip that we're going to listen to now, Phil talks about when he was a teenager and he moved out of his house in Kansas City, Missouri, and he moved to St. Louis, and he moved into George's house as well as working for him at the gym.
After high school, I moved to St. Louis and got a job with George.
Oh, okay.
And that's where the fun begins. I hope I shortened that story. I got there, and hey, what are you saying? I said, I don't have a place to stay, George. He goes, well, you can stay at my house. I lived with George Turner for 6 months.
That's crazy.
And 6 months, and that's where the stories begin.
I was scared to death of this guy at the gym. No longer live with him.
So was I. Now, we can go from here. Living with George.
Oh.
And it's funny because my mom wanted to know what was going on with me. My mom was pretty liberal with me. I mean, thank God she was. She knew I was driving to St. Louis.
Yeah.
And she said, just give me a call once a day. Tell me where you are. And, you know, she didn't make a big deal of it.
Right.
My mom was real cool. I was, you know, I was an adopted child. So I didn't have any, my parents weren't my biological parents.
Yeah.
They adopted me. So her and George had a conversation on the phone and I was there listening. And my mom told George, make a man out of him.
Oh.
Okay. And George said, I certainly will. So living with George, I mean, it was hanging out with George 24/7.
Oh.
I got to know his family. Had a beautiful house in West County, St. Louis, Missouri. Beautiful house. He had a 911 Porsche Carrera back in the 70s.
Wow, no kidding.
And so we used to drive around. We did radio talk shows.
Hmm.
We went to, he had three gyms at that time.
Wow.
He had one in Clayton, which became, I think one became a powerlifting gym. I can't remember which it was. He had one in North St. Louis, and he had one in South County, which is where we stayed. And it's funny because today, if you join a gym, I don't know if you noticed this, but if you join a gym today, you can go in. There's no one to show you how to use the equipment.
No.
Mm-mm. You're just kind of on your own.
Yeah.
And you see people doing the stupidest things I've ever seen done.
Yeah.
Right? So if you join George's gym, the thing I liked about George and looking back is that when you came to the gym and joined, George would set you up for a 3 day a week, you know, kind of workout schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, just whatever it was, would have been. And he would show you, we would show them how to do it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Which was nice because you don't see people come in and abuse the equipment. If George ever saw you, if George set you up on a program, he came in and saw you doing something that wasn't on that program, he would ask you, he would kick you out. If you dropped a weight, George would kick you out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, Tony. George would kick you out if you didn't have the right workout apparel on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
George would kick you out if he was in a bad mood.
If you make it noise and making banging weights together.
Oh, if you bang weights or made noise or just whatever.
Because you got one more time.
He'd warn you first. He'd give you a warning. One warning, and he would throw you out.
Here's your money back.
He would write you a check. He would write you a check and give you your money back. That's no joke. I've watched George throw more people out than I could count with a calculator. And if you gave me any lip, it's a fist fight.
That's true. He would take you outside.
He'd take you outside.
You guys saw him take, he would take people outside and actually get.
Oh, no, and beat the shit out of them. The police would come, they trained at George's. So they were friends with him.
Right.
So we never got in trouble.
Right.
Unbelievable.
George had one misfortune. He going to throw this guy out, but he didn't know the guy was a karate expert.
Oh, you remember that story?
Yeah.
He got his ass kicked.
He got his ass whipped. George took him outside. He got him beaten.
George got the shit beat out of him. Yes.
Wow, no shit.
I mean, go ahead, George, Tony.
He came back into his office, closed the door.
I mean, with George personally, I had a love-hate relationship with him. I loved the guy. I mean, truly loved the guy. If it wasn't for him, we may not be having this conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm saying here, likewise. I mean, it was a love-hate and fear relationship.
Exactly. And I was a bully kid that escaped bullying through bodybuilding, and I came back to the bully again, right. Which was kind of George.
Yeah.
I mean, but living in the house with George, this is a whole different story. You know, it's funny because he put me in one, he had a beautiful home. And he put me on the, I can't remember, I think it would have been, I don't remember what side of the house it was, to give you like north, south or whatever. But his kids were on the opposite side with his family. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of in a wing by myself. And I used to sit on the edge of bed and thinking, what the fuck am I doing here? I really did. And we'd wake up in the morning, we'd go to the gym, I'd ride with him, and we'd work during the day, do this, do that. And I mean, during the day, you see George, depending on what mood he was in, if he got a phone call, right, that could change everything. I kid you not. And the funniest thing, we did radio shows. We put on...
he was promoting a lot of shows.
Seminars, yeah, big promoter.
All right, now in this clip, we're going to continue our discussion with Phil Williams and Tony Pearson and they're going to both talk about some of the famous bodybuilders who trained at George's gym and also some other great George Turner stories.
Did they ever get like a lot of famous bodybuilders from around the country? Did they come into George's gym just to train there, or if they were in town?
Yeah, we had Dave Johns. Okay. We had Mike Mentzer come in. That's where I really learned how to train. And this is a funny story. I'm going to say, now that we say Mike Mentzer, Mike Mentzer came and did a seminar.
Okay.
And I have photos of this. And you can find photos here and there. He's got a George Turner's gym t-shirt on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's doing curls. He's doing this. He's doing a seminar in a white outfit.
Okay. I've seen those pictures. Yeah.
Okay. You know what I'm talking about? I was at that seminar. And I trained with Mike after that seminar. Mike stayed about an extra 10 days or so.
Hmm.
And George said, that's the brightest mother. This is the way he said it. I'm going to show you. That's the brightest mother sucker I've ever met. He the coolest fucking guy. He's so smart. I said, George, what he's teaching us goes against everything you said. And he went, fuck. He goes, fuck. Hey, cops, hey, the fuck that fucking walked away. No, this is the truth. Because he was talking about high heavy intensity duty training 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And George had to 6 days a week.
Yeah.
So he's telling me what a genius he was and how smart he was. I said, but how come his training goes against everything that you say? And George thought about it and he snapped. Oh, he stayed and talked to me for like a day and a half. I kid you not, guys. I kid you not. I mean, there's some crazy stories. There's another story where this power lifter came to South County. This guy, I don't know who this guy was. I couldn't remember his name. But this guy bench pressed like 600 pounds back then.
Yeah.
Or close to.
Yeah.
It was like five plus on each side.
Yes.
And George walked over, seen him load up the bar and said, what are you doing? He goes, what do you think you're going to do with that? He goes, I'm going to bench it. And he had another guy with him. And George said, oh, let me see. And the guy benched it. One rep, good and slow.
Yeah.
Good form, right?
Yeah.
And George looked at him. He goes, well, what do you think, George? He goes, we got arms like thumbs. I guess anybody could do that. So he insulted the guy. And he had some other son, Matt. And I got to know his kids a little bit because I lived in the house with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was funny because I never saw him. His daughter was a nice lady, nice girl. I mean, she wasn't a lady. They were all kids at the time.
Yeah.
His wife was very nice. And I mean, I remember sitting at the breakfast table with them. And if something wasn't right, he'd throw it at her. He hit her in the back of the head with a baked potato that wasn't done at dinner once.
Jesus. I know that story.
Oh, kid you not. Kid you not. He was, and he did it in restaurants.
Oh, my God.
My story from the restaurant. The restaurant next door, the baked potato was not the way he wanted. She walks away, and he threw it and hit her in the back of the head.
Yes, he did. And he did the same thing with his wife.
No.
The food wasn't right. It was like a frisbee, the plate.
Oh, you got to love George.
Yeah, yeah. And there's one time, before he started getting ready for the show, he said, I want you to help me. He said this to me, I want you to help me with my diet. Remind me not to eat anything that I shouldn't. I said, okay, George. I came down, got out of the shower in his house, came down the stairs. He's eating pancakes. I said, George, what about your diet? He went, fuck. He slammed it. And he took a jump. Kid you not. The story I'm going to tell you now is the best story I have. This is the best Turner story there is. I mean, I've seen him beat up a guy for a parking space.
No.
I can't remember. Oh, no, I do. He did. The guy beat him to the parking space. And George says, hey, I was going to park there. He goes, well, I guess I beat you to it. He said, oh, I'll beat you. And George punched the shit out of him. Did you not? This is the best story, though. This is the one that counts the most. His son, Matt, was probably he was in middle school, 12 or 13. And he was on the football field. And he passed out. And they found out, the ambulance came, took him to the hospital. We found out he had a heart condition, right? So this kid had to have open heart surgery. Now, here it goes. This is the good part. George comes in and tells us about it. And, of course, he's super depressed, right? And George is crying, right? And we're sitting around and we're kind of going, oh, shit, what do we say?
Yeah.
Myself, Cliff Coons, probably Jimmy Seeger, and maybe another guy or two. And remember the big guy, Joe?
Yes.
Tony, you remember Joe.
Joe, yes.
The big Italian guy.
Italian guy, right.
Oh, yeah. He was still there at that time.
Wow.
And so George tells us about his heart condition. He has to have open heart surgery. And we're real quiet. George is crying. And then suddenly, the next day or two, George becomes a born-again Christian. Oh, I'm not joking. And all of a sudden, we're having a prayer circle in the gym, right?
I kid you not,
for Matt. And I don't know what to say to George. I'm living in the house, and I'm around this the whole time, and I'm a kid. I don't know what to say, right?
Right.
And George says, I don't want any more profanity in my gym. We said, yes, sir. Yeah, we won't curse anymore, George. And I mean, he was reading the Bible while he was in his desk, mm-hmm. in his office. And in the evenings, we had a prayer circle for Matt. This went on for about 6 weeks or so.
Wow.
Once Matt got the okay that he was going to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was passing away from this particular disorder,
mm-hmm.
George went right back to where he was. He goes, hey, cocksuckers, you should see Matt. He's fucking cocksucker. That motherfucker. He's a shit. This is my kid. My kid. Hey, he's well past it. I said, George, I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, what about the profanity? He goes, fuck that guy. What's wrong with you? It was business as usual right after that. I kid you not.
All right. That was great stuff from Tony and Phil. That was one of my favorite interviews. That was such a funny show. Our next show here is from Dave McVeigh. Now, Dave is a film editor, and he was the one who edited Raw Iron. Raw Iron was a documentary about the movie Pumping Iron that came out in 2002, which was the 25th anniversary of Pumping Iron. And I believe they showed it on, I think it was HBO or Showtime, maybe. I can't remember. It was one of the cable channels. But anyways, in order for Dave to do a documentary about Pumping Iron, he got a chance to watch all 100 hours of footage about Pumping Iron that they filmed for the movie. Dave got to see all of that footage. And, of course, the movie was only about 100 minutes. So Dave got to see a lot of footage. So, of course, I asked Dave about his perceptions on editing the movie and seeing all that raw footage.
And then he worked with a guy named
Charles Gaines.
Gaines had written a book called Pumping Iron, which was the original inspiration for the documentary. But Gaines was not involved in the movie at all. I mean, he was shot. Actually, there's footage of him in the movie. They did, because he was very close with Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
And they did film some conversations between Gaines and Arnold, which were, some of those are in Raw Iron, but they're
right, remember that.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Because Gaines is very smart, kind of almost like an intellectual guy, but he was really into the bodybuilding scene. And Arnold's smarter than anybody, but doesn't, and they're having these, he's almost like a therapy session. And he's kind of like, But I feel like you use people. And he's like, of course I use people. Everybody uses people. And I get used too. Like, he just didn't understand the concept of not, he was, you know, he's just, he had that immigrant outlook on America, which is like, aren't we supposed to be trying to make something of our lives? Why do you keep asking me these deep questions? Like, right. I'm going to be the king of the world, man. Like, just leave me alone. But I mean, he didn't care. He wasn't bothered by it. But Gaines is always trying to like get more out of him, you know, like try and find his not necessarily his weakness, but his like vulnerability or something. And,
he didn't
have any. He literally doesn't. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Arnold.
Yeah.
And he's just not built that way. He doesn't, I mean, I'm sure he does in dark moments or whatever, but because everybody does, but my take on the guy himself is he's just like, he just is full on.
Like a Terminator.
Yeah. He's not going to get wrapped up in stupid stuff. He just, okay, you can get all in your head if you want and try and analyze every little moment, but I'm going to go be an actor.
How about the training footage, Dave? There had to be a ton of training footage, right?
Oh, God. More than, you know, you can possibly imagine. I mean, you figured there how much of it was in the movie. Imagine how much of it wasn't.
Right.
You know, it starts to get a little repetitive after a while, I have to be honest with you. When you're screening the footage and you know you're looking for things that are interesting that weren't in the movie. Like the point of the making of, the point of Raw Iron was to show outtakes, to show different angles, to show things that were not in the movie. And there's plenty of training in the movie. So it was interesting. I mean, it was obviously always cool to see all that footage in the original Gold's Gym in Venice and where they worked out and, you know, that it wasn't a thing yet. So they were just not like a cool gym at all, but it was all they needed.
Right.
I think I would say what I got the most out of watching the training footage was just how focused they were. I mean, they were really into it and there was no money in it, you know, so
right.
It's a little different, you know. There's like, they did it because they were really into it. I think that's a whole different deal. They're like hobbyists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? There was no money. I mean, Arnold might have been making some money, but none of those guys were getting rich working that hard.
No.
So you have to, like, you watch it with that perspective. You're like, wow, these guys are doing this because they actually enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool though. I mean, it was the other training. The other thing, I'm just gonna blab and
yeah, go ahead.
I haven't thought about it in a while, but the other thing I will say that I think does come across in the movie, but I think it actually comes across even a little bit more in Raw Iron, is how much they all liked each other. Mm. Like, they were buddies. It's clear, and it was even more clear in the outtakes that they were they were friends and they were having fun and they knew it was weird and you know, or they knew that they were part of a subculture. They loved, you know, the walking into a restaurant together and just being these gigantic guys. And
yeah,
I think they were having fun with it. And I really, it was hilarious to see how they would just bust balls and they didn't give a shit, man. I'm sorry. I didn't mean this part. They didn't care. They were just buddies having fun in the '70s in Venice. So that's pretty fun.
Now, how about the footage of Lou training in New York? Was there a lot of that too?
Yeah, there was a ton of outtakes from that. I mean, you could definitely have gone. I think I respect his choices, Butler's choices on how much. When you see a movie that's done and it's good, you always say, well, he did it perfectly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You use the exact same right amount because you love it the way it is.
Right.
But if he had wanted to go deeper into Lou's relationship with his father, he probably could have done that because that was the biggest thing that was not in the movie. It's touched on, but Maddie was definitely, that's Lou's dad, was mm-hmm. definitely, you know, a very big personality. He wanted to be on camera. He worshipped Arnold. All out of proportion,
really?
In my opinion. You know, he knew Arnold was the big gun, and I mean, I don't know. I'm inferring a bit, but just from watching the footage, I felt like he was playing to the camera that Lou's dad was saw the movie as an opportunity for him.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Much too.
Almost like a stage father or something. You know, like mm-hmm. he's here about those actor kids that have like these kind of obnoxious parents, and he comes off. There's a lot of stuff of that where he's really stagey. And Lou was, you know, the other thing about it was that Lou did not have a very good hearing aid at the time. So he was really having even more trouble understanding what was going on around him.
Oh, really?
And I think that was a little, I mean, documentary. It's like reality TV. That's kind of almost what they were doing. In hindsight, and it doesn't matter because you see how great, how awesome Lou is, and you know how much he got out of the experience. I do think that in the outtakes, you get the sense that Lou's not even really understanding what's happening around him, and his dad's talking to the camera, and there's all this stuff happening, and Lou's can't hear. But he ends up coming off as unintelligent, I think, partially because of the hearing issue, and that's kind of like a little unfair.
Yeah.
Especially because we got to know him, you know, because we interviewed him afterwards and quite a bit and spent time with him and realized what a sweet guy he is. It was kind of, that was a little rough, but you know, it's the way it goes.
Yeah. Was there footage between Maddie and Lou that was seemed like it was genuine, where Maddie wasn't acting like a stage father?
I didn't see much of it.
Okay.
I mean, it's tough though, because I'm just a guy watching footage. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know the reality. It's talking about judging somebody's relationship with their father is a little presumptuous, I would say, of me to really know the deal. Although Lou's talked about it. He even talked about it in the interview that he did with us.
Oh, really?
He's never been. Well, he says it. And if you watch Ryan, he talks about how his dad was, you know, a tough, like, he's a very well-adjusted guy. And he realized that his dad was not maybe the worst and the best thing that ever happened to him. You know, like that's always the case. If you have like a hard driving dad, it can be like really damaging and at the same time be the reason you end up mixed bag, whatever. But yeah, I mean, Maddie was always playing to the cameras and he didn't seem to me to be all that affectionate towards Lou. I think he saw Lou as a character in the movie. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't thinking of him as his son at that time, which, you know, he probably is shrewd enough to know that there was a story being made up in this documentary and that his role was to play the sort of hard driving stage father. And Lou is supposed to be just this big lunk who's just, you know, lifting as much weight as possible in this crappy little gym in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And he was smart enough to play his part, but I never got the sense that Lou actually knew what was really going on.
Okay. All right, in this part of our clip with Dave, Dave talks about George Butler's decision to cast, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger in the leading role and how he was contemplating using Frank Zane as the leading role in the movie, and he decided to go with Arnold over Zane.
Butler did what any smart filmmaker would do if you essentially discovered this diamond in the rough.
Right.
You're going to follow that. I mean, that's just like Arnold was too interesting, not just about his bodybuilding, but his personality. That's what it was. I mean, he has the biggest personality just ever.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what even the critics loved about Pumping Iron was that it focused on the different personalities of the bodybuilders. Because if they just would have focused on the muscles, I think they would have lost a lot of people. And it only would have been interesting to the bodybuilding community. But I think it appealed to the general public because they focused on personalities.
Absolutely. And Butler, I think the fact that Butler was not a fitness guy, that he was kind of like a little, not little, but he was just a regular dude.
Yeah.
He was intelligent. He's a very intelligent, well-educated person. Mm-hmm. Probably helped because he wouldn't make that movie. He's not going to make a movie that's like a how to get gigantic biceps.
Right.
Like that wouldn't be interesting to a guy like that. But he's smart enough to realize, wait a minute, these are interesting characters. Like they've all got their own little stories. Like that's why it's a great movie. And him focusing in on the personalities of the bodybuilders was a really good call.
Yeah. How did Zane come across in the footage? All that stuff they shot of him. Was he interesting?
Not particularly.
Okay.
Not to me. I don't want this to come across as like, cause I know he's very smart and he's a very cool guy, and he's obviously, like, there was nothing, like, he came off as a very smart, cool, intelligent person, but not right for interesting, dynamic documentary. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I liked it, but I was kind of like, I was thinking about it as I was watching, because I made documentaries as I was making a documentary about a documentary, which mm-hmm. is like very complicated, but you know what I'm saying. So yeah. I remember when I was screening the footage thinking, I don't think you can build something around this guy. He's too together. Like he's kind of got his crap together. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily, I'm not saying Arnold didn't, but he just was too, too normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily great for a documentary. You kind of want the wacky characters to make it more interesting. So it's nothing against Zane. It's just not necessarily right for something like that. I think Zane is the kind of guy you would have wanted to do the training documentary about how to do it right. And he would get into the science of muscles and, you know, because he knew all that stuff. He's extremely smart.
Yeah.
And almost like a mathematical mind about training.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not necessarily a mainstream. That's very niche. Nowadays, that would be, people would love it because you could do it on YouTube and he could have his own thing. But if you're trying to do a mainstream documentary to appeal to a big audience,
you don't want the guy
who's normal.
Yeah.
But Arnold was always like, he liked the first cut that we made. You know, he was fantastic. We thought, oh, home run. And then, you know, a year later, we're still, or whatever it was. But we did get to do, this is kind of a cool story.
All right. And our final excerpt with Dave McVeigh, we talk about Dave going over to Arnold's house to see a first run screening of the movie after they had it partially edited. This is really funny.
One of the rough cuts, and I still consider, I was the editor copy, and you know, I was very nervous about it. But anyway, he's just an open guy. He just always likes everything. He wanted to do a screening, you know, with Maria and some friends or whatever, and they called us and said, you should come. And like, of course. And it was in Palisades, which is where he lived. And he had this, and so we drive up there, and he's got caterers coming in. Like, there's caterers parked outside the house. Uh-huh. They're bringing in this gigantic, like, not a big screen TV, but like a movie theater. I'm like, oh shit. I mean, this thing is still like a little rough.
Right.
You know,
right.
I just thought it was going to be like him and a few buddies.
Right.
And he had invited everybody and they had food. It was catered. It was like a big deal. And I was just like, oh, I mean, I was excited because there was one moment because I remember, because, you know, it was me and my brother Scott and we were like, this is amazing. Even though we were both nervous.
Right.
Again, we weren't expecting, it wasn't done basically.
Right.
And, but you get in there and all of a sudden like Franco's there and some of the other bodybuilders were there. And that guy, Rolf, his buddy Rolf, who's in, Gladiator.
Gladiator, yeah.
German guy. He was there and like Eunice and Sergeant Shriver were there. Like his parents, like legendary, like what a insane mix of people. And they turned down the lights and like watched it, man. And it was awesome. Even though, you know, again, it was kind of, was a little like nervous because there was like a lot of, you know, rough patches. We wasn't ready for that kind of scene.
Right.
But of course it's Arnold and all his friends and it was him, you know? Yeah. So they all cheered and, you know, we were like, it was just fantastic, you know? And it was like one of those things. And that's like Arnold, you know, he likes to have fun. He's sort of like, why wouldn't you cater it? Like, you know, and it was like really special, you know? And then of course we ended up staying for like 4 hours getting notes afterwards.
Wow.
But, really? But Arnold was just smoking a cigar and going, it's fine. It's fine. It's fantastic. Like he was done. He was ready to do tries. He was ready to ship it.
Right.
But I was just kind of like, wow, like we're right in the middle of this and what a nice gesture. Like he didn't need to do that. He made us feel like superstars, even though we were telling him, like, you know, that's what makes him, I mean, not just his personality, but he also knows a thing or two about human nature. And I think he's, you know, he won us over. And I don't think that it was BS. I think he really does actually care about those types of things and wants people to enjoy themselves. You know, he's definitely got a life short, you know, attitude about things.
Yeah.
And that was cool.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that one. That was a great night.
Yeah. Wow. All right. And one of our more interesting interviews that I've done in the last year was with Charlotte Parker. Charlotte Parker is an agent for movie stars. And she was the primary agent for Arnold Schwarzenegger during the prime of his career.
She started working with him for Conan the Destroyer, which was the sequel to Conan the Barbarian. And she worked with him all through Terminator and Commando and Predator and all the major movies that Arnold did in the 1980s. So in this part of our clip, Charlotte talks about her vision for Arnold, where she saw him going as a major movie star.
Commando was, you know, Joel Silver was the producer, but that was a big studio picture. So I lobbied, you know, like crazy, and he did Commando, and that turned out to be big.
Yeah. Now, when you say studio picture, so Conan the Barbarian, that wasn't a studio picture.
It was. But then he did that. But then he did
Conan the Destroyer.
Then he did Terminator.
Oh, okay. Terminator was a smaller movie.
Yeah, it was a smaller movie, and he was being handed smaller movies.
Mm.
You know, like independent films.
Okay.
And that was not the vision that I had for him.
Right.
Despite the fact that that's what he was being offered through a variety of different things.
Yeah.
My vision for him was major A-list.
Yeah, right. Biggest star in the world.
Yeah, that's most my vision.
Okay.
And I, you know, my ability to manifest my vision is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and obviously he was someone who was completely prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want me to tell you what I thought of him, he has a charisma that is so astounding. Mm-hmm. When you're in his presence, he has something that I call an X factor.
Okay.
Okay. So I used to be with him all the time when he did his interviews.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in the room, or I scheduled them and I was in the room.
Yeah.
But I used to feel when I left him, when I would leave the room, I would feel like I could do anything. I could walk on water. I could accomplish anything.
Right.
Because he's a very inspiring person.
He is. Right. Right.
Can do kind of guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's so.
It's funny you say that, because when I would see him on like the Tonight Show or something, just that little burst of him on there, I'd be like, that's how I felt. I felt life affirming, you know. Or if
yes,
I see him,
very life affirming. I have to tell you that after he did the Tonight Show for the Terminator, he came back in and we dissected it.
Yeah.
He said, what do you think I did that worked or what didn't work? And so he really, you know, he was someone I would say early on who understood the importance of publicity, of public relations, how to use it.
Right, right.
You know, what to do with it. Not everyone had that understanding.
Right, right.
But well, aside...
I remember the story when his book, Education of a Bodybuilder, came out in 1977. Mm-hmm. I read this somewhere. I think it was his, one of the stories or his autobiography or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to the publishing company and they said, you know, well, we'll put you on this little book tour. And he goes, no, I want to go to every major city in the United States. So they booked it out. You know, he understood how important it was to go to all these cities and be there and publicize it himself. And I remember living in Chicago at the time, and I would hear him on the radio, you know, and then he would be on the local television show, on the news, advertising it, and he would be in all the newspapers. So he really was a workhorse. He understood, like you said, the value of publicity.
Yeah, no, he really, really, really did. Always. He always, and I think that made him very valuable too, to a lot of the people that he worked for, a lot of the studios and the few, because he was willing to do everything that it took. A lot of the very big stars at the time considered themselves, well, you know, I'm not going to do this or that, or yeah, I'm only going to do so much, but he gave it full force all the time.
All right. And now here comes one of my absolute favorite guests in the last 4 years that I've done the show. It was Jack Neary. Jack was a writer for Muscle Builder magazine. And I remember reading Jack's articles as I got into bodybuilding in the late 70s. Jack started working for Joe Weider in 1976. So in this clip, we got two stories from Jack about Arnold. The first one was when he went with Arnold in 1976 to watch the IFBB Mr. America contest that was won by Mike Mentzer. And then the second one was another outing that he had with Arnold, which I believe was 1977, when they went to the North America contest in Canada, and how Jack got stuck in the airport. Great stuff. Here we go.
And he was getting noticed beyond the bodybuilding world into the Hollywood celebrity world.
Right.
And I think he was interested in me because my interest in writing and literary things and that sort of thing. And he hired me to write his bodybuilding courses for his mail order courses.
Oh, Oh, wow.
So I ghost wrote and designed all of those. I mean, he had a batch before, but I don't know who wrote his first batch, but I did a whole renewal of them. It was about 10 different booklets. And of course, that was a big source of revenue for him in those days.
Yeah.
You know, the mail order ads in the back of Weeders magazine. And, you know, there were a couple of guys that did it, but Arnold was really the pioneer of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I worked on that and he really liked what I did. And I spent a lot of time art directing. I'm not that I'm really a designer, but I put that effort to work and he was really happy with it. And, you know, I used to go to his house all the time. And in those days, his interest in politics, it was a fledgling budding interest. I remember one night, a Sunday evening, we watched the 76 presidential debate between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter together.
Okay.
And he was pulling for Ford. He was a young Republican in the making. Right. And, you know, and we were really caught up in it. And so I got to see a side of Arnold that a lot of, you know, fans wouldn't have got to see.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
And he was really...
That's kind of my favorite time of Arnold's life. You know, I'm a big Arnold fan. I've read a ton of books about him, a ton of biographies about him. And I really like that period in Arnold's life between when he retired from bodybuilding until he made it big in acting, which is probably like a 5-year period. And he really wasn't well known by the general public, but it seemed like, you know, when I watch interviews with him on like the Tonight Show in like 1978, 79, around that era, he's very articulate. He's very honest. It had to be a great, great period to know him in his life then, you know, before he became a really big star.
Well, you had a sense that this was a guy who was going places. You know, he wasn't going to just be a retired bodybuilder. And he really was eager to cultivate a presence in the film scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is, of course, before Conan, which was his first big break.
Right.
But he was, you know, courting interest among the press. And I'll never forget one of the greatest weeks of my life, thanks to Arnold's generosity. It coincided around the 1976 Mr. America contest. That was probably the last time they called them Mr. contests. You know, then they went to things like American Bodybuilding Championships and World Bodybuilding Championships, because Ben Weider wanted bodybuilding to be considered for inclusion in the Olympics. And that sounded more like a sport than a Mr., like a beauty pageant kind of attitude. So the Mr. America contest, that was the one won by Mike Mentzer in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I'd ever been to New York. I was wide-eyed with wonder at the skyscrapers and the whole scene. And Arnold and I actually shared a hotel room at Howard Johnson's in Times Square.
No kidding.
For that week. I know. I mean, he was pretty frugal in those days, as was I. And, and he was a judge at the contest. And, of course, the contest was notable because it was the first time Mike Mentzer really burst onto the scene and everybody was in awe of him, this young, amazing talent with huge arms and a little bit, not the greatest poser in the world in those days, but you know, a young star in the making. But Arnold was also, he had set up a lot of, you know, interviews with various media outlets. And I remember at the night of the contest, Arnold, even though he was a judge, he left early from the evening show because he was asked to be the date of Candace Bergen.
Oh, wow.
as her kind of escort to the Saturday Night Live filming. It was in the early days of Saturday Night Live
at
NBC. And so Arnold sort of took off and went with Candace for that. And, you know, the show finished up and I interviewed Mike and a bunch of the other guys of the time. And can't remember all the guys who did well in the various classes, but it was a great show.
Yeah.
And I was back at the hotel room. I was, you know, it was like midnight and I'm sitting in bed reading and suddenly the phone rings and it's, what are you doing? It's Arnold. And he says, you want to come to an after party and get dressed and come down now. And so I got dressed. I had just blue jeans and a T-shirt. You know, I was way underdressed. And I went to this really swanky club called Park Avenue 1/5, which was kind of done up like an old Titanic ocean liner.
Oh,
and it had like you had to open a porthole to get in, like, you know, they had to look at you through a porthole to let you in. And I knocked on the door and they said, who are you? I said, I'm a guest of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I was going, they probably don't know who this guy is. And, you know, oh, yeah, Arnold. And, you know, and suddenly Arnold was at the door and he ushered me in. And the first guy I met was Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
And when he heard that I worked for Weeders magazine, like he was into fitness and he was into vitamins and nutrition and all of that stuff. He bored the tears off me. Like I couldn't get rid of the guy. He was going on and on for half an hour. Wow. He said, I got these terrible calcium deposits on my fingers because it affected his guitar playing. And he said, what do I take? What do I take, inositol or choline, or what do I take for these calcium deposits? Because I didn't have the slightest idea, but I would sort of bluff my way along with it.
Right.
And we had this half hour conversation, and then Arn says, come and sit at the table. And it was just madness. It was just, everyone was drunk and crazy. And there was this giant table, a round table. And I'm sitting there, and there's Arnold on one side of me, and I sense a presence on my right side. And this guy turns to me and says, oh, hello, Jack. How are you? And it's Jack Nicholson.
No.
And yeah, there's Jack Nicholson sitting there, and he goes, oh, my name's Jack too. And I said, yeah, I know. And he said, tell me, Jack, what have you been up to this summer? And I said, oh, well, I've just moved down from Canada, and I'm working at the Leader magazine, explaining, you know, of course, he had no, wasn't impressed in the least by that. And
right.
I said, what have you been doing this summer, Jack? And he says, I've been sitting on the back of a yacht reading scripts in the Mediterranean. And I said, oh, well, that's a summer.
Yeah.
So, and then he said, have you met Mick? And I stand up, and Mick Jagger is across the table.
Oh, man, unbelievable.
He is absolutely shit-faced, pardon my language, legless, like he's just hammered. He could barely stand. He kind of extends his hand, and he's wearing this robin's egg blue blazer, very striking jacket. I'll never forget it. And I shake his hand, and I met Keith Richards, and, you know, all the Rolling Stones were there. And,
right,
you know,
right.
And so, you know, the night unfolded from there. It was just madness. And
was John Belushi there and the guys from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. And, you know, it was the very early cast, John Belushi, when he was still alive. And, of course, it was the night on Saturday Night Live that Joe Cocker had been the musical guest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And John Belushi did a great imitation
of Joe Cocker. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So that was pretty, it was a pretty special moment for me, you know, just to be eyewitness to that. And on that same trip, we had lunch. Arnold, we went to Elaine's, which was a very popular Upper East Side salon, the restaurant where a lot of celebrities would go, Woody Allen, guys like that.
Right.
We met Dustin Hoffman and Robert Towne, who wrote the screenplay for Chinatown, guys like that.
Right.
And we met Andy Warhol, you know, the great pop artist.
Right.
And Andy invited Arnold, oh, you should come to the factory and do a lunch with us and do an interview for Interview magazine. And Arnold didn't really know who Andy Warhol was.
Hmm.
And he asked me later, he said, you know, who is this Andy guy? He seems kind of weird. What should I go and meet him? Should I meet him? And I said, yeah, you're damn right. You should meet him. I mean, he's a legendary artist. He's a cultural icon.
Right.
And I said, Interview magazine is also very influential for celebrity culture.
Yeah.
So Arnold, the next day, Arnold and I went together to the factory near Union Square in New York. And I'll never forget that we walk into the lobby of the offices there, and there's a Great Dane stuffed like a taxidermy, like a Great Dane, you know, just there. It's just something you don't see every day. And we were ushered into this boardroom, and there was an enormous moose head, like another stuffed animal, a moose head at the head of the table where Andy sat. And they did this box lunch, the best sandwiches I've ever had, tuna sandwiches. Uh-huh. And in boxes, and Andy, who hardly said two words, like his editor, Bob Policello, did most of the questions for the interview. And Arnold was very charming, and everyone really took Arnold because he had such a magnetic personality.
Right.
And then after the interview, Andy himself took Arnold and I behind the scenes to the factory where he makes all his famous silkscreen paintings. You know, various celebrities and stuff that are worth millions today. And, you know, he showed us the process, which I found really interesting. And, you know, that was another great glimpse into a world that I never would have had access to if it wasn't for Arnold's kindness, you know, instead of including me in all of that.
Right. Wow. What was it like? Tell me a little bit more about hanging out with Arnold, because he's such an icon now. And he's, you know, is one of the world's biggest movie stars ever. But you knew him before all that. I heard it.
I'll relay one story I remember vividly. I don't know if this will get me in trouble or not for telling it, but, you know, here goes. On that trip to Vancouver for the Mr. North America, Arnold and I had been at a party the night before, and we were flying out on the Sunday morning back to Los Angeles from Vancouver. And I don't know why, but Arnold had my airplane ticket. He was wearing a blazer, a Navy blazer for the flight. And he had my airplane ticket, my return ticket, in his breast pocket. And we were seatmates, and we flew from Vancouver to, in those days, he had to stop off in San Francisco and change planes and carry on the rest of the way for the last leg. And somehow Arnold and I got separated in the airport, and he had my return ticket for the last leg in his pocket.
Okay.
And I couldn't get on the plane. I had nothing. I didn't have even a credit card in those days, you know.
Yeah,
I'm 21 years old. I had a couple of quarters in my pocket, and Arnold takes off on the plane without me with my ticket. I have no way of getting back home to Los Angeles.
And
I had parked my car in front of his house a couple of days before that, and we drove together to the airport to LAX. So I needed to get to his place and get to my car and get home and then report to work the next day at Weider. And, you know, so I said, oh God, so Arnold's got my plane ticket. I went to it was PSA Airlines, but it used to exist in those days. And I went up to the desk and I said, look, you know, my friend Arnold, they didn't have any idea who Arnold was. And I said, you've got my ticket. I have no way of getting back. I don't know. I was trying to find a way to get onto a plane. And of course I had no cash. And Arnold, his routine in those days was he would go to the Venice Beach on Sunday afternoons.
Okay.
And sort of suntan and hang out with the guys and gossip and just sort of be, you know, just the guys getting together on the beach. It was a big deal and part of bodybuilding culture at that time. And so Arnold went from landing at the airport to LA straight to the beach. He never went home. And I'm calling his house. I got my one quarter and I'm calling his house. And I keep getting his mother. His mother was visiting from Austria. She didn't speak any English. And I didn't speak any German. And I'm trying to communicate with her. Where's Arnold? Where's Arnold? And I'd met her actually a few days before. And I don't know if she knew who I was, but I was trying to acquaint her, you know, I don't know if you remember me kind of thing. But, you know, so that didn't go very far. And then I figured out he must have gone to the beach. And there was this course. This is before cell phones.
Right.
Way before, you know, and, you know, it was pay phones in those days.
Right.
So I'm hanging out in the San Francisco airport for hours on end. I'm being harassed by Hare Krishnas and, you know, just, you know, the whole thing. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And I finally, about 6 o'clock that evening, Arnold comes home from the beach and I get him at home. He said, where are you? What's, you know, like, it's my fault. He started yelling at me, like, where was I, you know? I said, you've got my ticket, you know? And, I said, is there any way you can get to the airport or call the airline and wire another ticket to, you know, get me on the next plane? So he takes care of that. And I said, also, can you pick me up? Because I didn't even have fare for the taxi to his place in Santa Monica then. And so he picks me up in his incredible car. He used to drive these big 6.9 liter engine Mercedes. It was a silver tank of a car.
Yeah.
He used to keep it immaculate. And Arnold picked me up. It's like 8:30 at night, just dark out. And he's got a friend with him. Bernd Zimmermann was his name. He was a guy who ran a chain of studios, health studios in Austria and Germany. That was a karate guy and really nice guy. He looked like George Papard, the actor.
Okay.
And he was in the A-team. And so Arnold was driving. Bernd was in the front right passenger seat. I'm sitting directly behind Arnold. And we're starting to drive towards Marina del Rey. And running along the northern boundary of LAX is an east-west road. I forget what the name of the road is that leads you into Marina del Rey. And we're taking this road. It's a really dark. There's no other traffic around us, dead quiet. And suddenly Arnold swerves the car over to the side of the road and he says something in German to Bernd and they have this sort of agreement or something. And suddenly the car pulls over and Arnold opens his driver's side door. And I see that he's pulled into view a .357 Magnum pistol. You know, I go, my God, what the hell is, I thought they're going to shoot me or something. And Arnold stands up and puts his gun out into the night sky and shoots off 4 rounds into the sky. Like directly above, like right by the airport. He wasn't trying to hit an airplane. Let me be clear on that. I think he had just bought this new gun and he was like a kid. He really wanted to let it go. And so he fires the gun and I see these giants, like a cannon going off, these giant sparks shooting up into the night sky. And I'm thinking, my God, and Barrett's laughing and Arnold's laughing. And suddenly he gets in and puts hides the gun under his seat and zooms off like a getaway. And we go home. And that was the end of that night. You know? I've told that story to friends and no one's ever believed me. And I hope Arnold doesn't sue me for that, but it's the God's truth. That's what I witnessed it with my own eyes.
Oh, that's crazy.
But that's the kind of guy he was. He was a prankster. He liked to have a good time.
Right. He had to be so much fun to hang out with. And you spent the whole week with him in that hotel room. That would be crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right. One of my most popular shows from last year, from 2020, was when I interviewed Barbara Outland. Barbara was the first girlfriend of Arnold Schwarzenegger. She met him in 1969 after Arnold had arrived in this country about a year earlier. And they lived together and were boyfriend and girlfriend until 1975 when Arnold retired from bodybuilding. So Barbara wrote a book called Arnold and Me that came out probably about 7-8 years ago. It was a really good book. If you guys want to check that out, you can get it on Amazon. So I got a chance to interview Barbara and we talked about her book and we talked about her relationship with Arnold. So in this clip, Barbara talks about how Arnold approached the competition because she did get to see him in all his prime years when he was winning the universe and the Mr. World, and of course, all those Mr. Olympia competitions.
Yeah, one of the interesting parts of your book, too, was when Arnold came back from his trip and he hurt his knee. It was on crutches. And he came to your apartment. And I think you were really hoping for a reunion between the two of you because he was gone for a while and you were looking forward to getting married. And he was very pensive during dinner. And then at the end of dinner, he just said, "My father died."
You have good reading comprehension. Yeah, it was like, okay, here I am expecting like an engagement proposal, and I'm here. Boom, after dinner, you just happened to tell me that very solemnly. I mean, how could you, even though he didn't have a close relationship with his father, you can't deliver that news without just feeling some real sadness.
Yeah.
And so he did show that. But as you know, in reading the book, he was training. And of course, at that point, training was just like everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't understand the compassion that he would now, that his mother was kind of alone, you know? I mean, Erica was there, but his mother, I think she had, you know, distant relatives. She had a family around her, but not her son, and already her other son had died.
Yeah.
But he didn't go back, and I'm sure that is one regret he still has.
Yeah, well, that dinner, right, you got really mad at him, and you were yelling at him because he didn't show any compassion for, like, his father dying. He didn't, like, show any emotions, and he just left, and then the next day he called, and I think he tried to explain it to you, right?
Yes. I mean, this was how it kind of went, you know, that he would regroup and he would think back on what I'd said to him. And it's like, you know, it's not like a normal relationship. I mean, I love my father deep down, but, you know, he preferred Meinhardt over me. That was his brother. Mm-hmm. And always set up a competition between the two boys, whether it was picking a handful of flowers and how big is it? Okay, Meinhardt won again.
Yeah, right.
So he just always felt like, okay, I'm down again. I'm down again. Mm-hmm. And so I think really now he sees the advantage to all of that, that it made him a driver.
Yeah.
That it got him out of Austria, into Germany, into the United States. And he really just has that drive that we all recognize totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it amazing how, you know, those initial things with his father and his brother drove him so much? Because that, that's what, you know, in the bodybuilding community, that's what we've always admired about Arnold, was how driven he was, how much of a winner he was, how he would win at all costs, even if he had to psych out his opponents or whatever. But it was amazing that was the initial thing, was his relationship with his dad and the way his dad preferred his brother over him. And it drove him to such extent where he just, for years, I mean, it wasn't just a short-term thing. It was for years, he drove himself that hard to be the winner.
Right. And one thing that really always stunned me is after he would win every year, it was like, oh, but wait till next year.
Right.
Like, well, wait a minute. Why don't you just love and appreciate that all of your hard work this year amounted to another title?
Yeah.
No, just wait till next year. So I think that is kind of typical of somebody who strives, that you don't live in the moment of now and you don't get it. This yeah. moment now, I just won. Well, who cares? I'm living into the future again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we all change as we mature, but that was definitely a driver at that point.
Yeah. I've interviewed a lot of bodybuilders, and it seems like that's a common theme with a lot of them, is they don't appreciate the win when it happens. You know, they're always like thinking about the next time.
Right, right.
Just enjoy them. And then years later when they get older, they're like, wow, I really would have wished I would have enjoyed that when I was at my peak and I was looking so good. I just wish
right.
I enjoyed that victory, you know?
I mean, it's so special.
Yeah, yeah.
You competed and you were looked upon by millions and you don't get it?
Yeah.
No, next year. And Frank Zane, again, I mentioned him again, he was a psychologist and a Buddhist in his heart.
Yeah.
And he really had studied that most bodybuilders had a bad relationship with their father.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you might have met the same pattern when you interviewed winners. Yeah. It's like, no, it's going to be next time. I'm going to prove, and maybe to the father or who knows what, but you know, it's the old kicking the sand in the face, you know, that they really need to prove themselves, and yet they don't get that they just proved themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting that a lot of bodybuilders had bad relationships with their fathers, or they long for their father's attention, and the way they build them, they literally build themselves up more masculine in order to get
right.
approval, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
And Mitz from Hawaii, he also was telling you that too, right? That Arnold's relationship with his father is what really was the driving force in his life.
Right, exactly. And Mitz was another father figure. And
right.
Dot.
Right.
They were just a beautiful Hawaiian couple. And
yeah.
he met them over, you know, through a bodybuilding, like little, not a contest, but an exhibition.
Exhibition, yeah. The one him and Dave Draper went out. Yeah.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Did Arnold ever talk about the competitions he was in? Because you were with him during his real... like pretty much his whole career from when he got here in 68 all the way up until 75 when he retired. So did he ever talk about like Sergio Oliva or some of these other guys that he was going up against?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was that typical, almost teenager, like gossip of, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to beat him and you know, all of that. Now he loved the local guys at Gold's, but let's face it, even with Franco, they had a competition of how many reps they could do, you know. So they had a loving, you know, fake fighting relationship. And yeah. he was the same way with Louis Ferrigno. Or now, there was East Coast versus West Coast. And
right.
so all of you bodybuilders probably know that. And his core was bodybuilders. And he loved them, but he wanted to beat them.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. And in this clip, Barbara continues talking about Arnold. We talk about the year 1973, where the Mr. Olympia contest was held in New York. And this was the year that George Butler and Charles Gaines were interviewing Arnold about the book Pumping Iron. And so they were, of course, interested in bodybuilding. They were going to all the shows. And they traveled with Arnold and Barbara to New York for the Mr. Olympia contest that year. And so Barbara talks about that trip and about how Arnold had this great self-confidence, even at a young age.
You said there was an interesting story in there when I think you guys went to New York in 73 for the Mr. Olympia. And you said that was one of the few contests you went to with Arnold, right? You only saw him.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah. And I liked how you guys were going out to all these different places. Like you went to Brooklyn, I think, to see, was it Artie Zeller's family?
Art Zeller's mom. And
yeah.
So, yeah, we really got around and then we went to, you know, fancy restaurants and
right.
we stayed in I think Hemingway had been famous for staying there.
Yeah, yeah, I remember. I just read that this weekend, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you said that
It was very exciting for me because of my literate background and just, you know, well, it's not the New York it is today. Right. It was the New York of then, and it was just so exciting.
Yeah, and you said the people there were very high class, but Arnold, with his self-confidence, he didn't let it get to him at all. He was still having a good time. And
you know, how can you have so much confidence? He just didn't care.
Right.
And now, inside, maybe, was he covering up and bluffing it? But yeah. I just don't think so.
Right. And he was always like that, right, Barbara, from the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we met, he was just, like, really confident to meet, you know, a kind of, in his mind, an upper-class girl. And forget that I'm a country bumpkin from Austria. He didn't care.
Right.
He just had so much confidence in his personality and his wit and his potential. I think that's maybe... Well, I know that working out in a gym, and you probably can relate to it, that you it just gives you a confidence to have mastery of your body.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know that then. I mean, I just came from a Pilates class just now. So I know now what it's like to have more of a mastery over my body than I did then. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's what gave him such utter confidence.
Yeah, that's really... What separated Arnold, I think, from a lot of other bodybuilders was I think a lot of bodybuilders, they build up this wall of muscle, you know, to feel more secure, but inside they're really insecure. And I think what happens when you get to these contests, you can see that a lot. But Arnold always had this great confidence in himself. Was he like that when you first met him when he was 22?
Yeah. Well, at least the way I could read it from then.
Yeah.
He just was always confident of everything he said, everything he did, every purchase that he made. He was totally frugal to save up money for eventually his first apartment complex where he could live in the manager's apartment.
Okay.
I mean, who does that?
Right.
You know?
Was that a plan of his? Was from the first time you met him? Did he envision that coming up later? Or did that
I think he, America? You know, because of Joe Weider and even Ben Weider, he was surrounded by very successful businessmen and in the council of that, John Balick, you know, he just learned that you need to invest and don't care about your immediate gratification. Just invest for the future so right. that you can expand and grow.
Yeah.
All right. And one of my favorite guests from over the last year or so was Ed Connors. Ed was one of the owners of Gold's Gym during the late 1970s and 80s. He owned it with Pete Grimkowski and Tim Kimber, and they were the ones that really brought Gold's into the franchising, and they made it super popular around the world. So before that, Gold's Gym was just a very small gym out in Venice, California. It was owned, of course, by Joe Gold at first, and then Ken Sprague owned it for a few years. So Ed and Pete and Tim bought it from Ken Sprague. And so Ed gives us the whole story about how they purchased the gym and how they started to expand it and eventually franchised it.
When Ken owned it and you guys bought it from it, wasn't making money. Wasn't that considered the mecca of bodybuilding even back then?
It was, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't working as a business really back then.
Okay.
It was, I know when Pete, Tim and I, our first year, you know, we owned it most of 79. We grossed about $250,000, and I think we lost $15,000.
Hmm.
So it was, we was actually only making money because of the T-shirt sales, and then Weider pulled our ad.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was painful, and I eventually resolved things with Joe, but no, it was. It was, you know, it was basically a small business.
Hmm. Wow. So, what did you guys do different, Ed?
We moved it back down to Venice in 1981.
Okay.
Eighty-one, which was our good fortune because I was working for the office of Charles Eames. Have you ever heard of the Eames chair?
No. Mm-mm.
He's a famous American designer.
Okay.
He had just died, and his wife wanted some help finishing up some architectural projects. So I was working down there in Venice at the corner of Brooks and Abbot Kinney.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a warehouse for rent down the street, which was the first bay of a 4-bay warehouse building, 6,600 square feet. So we were having problems with our landlord. I was also working on the parking structure for Frank Gehry's new shopping center in Santa Monica. So I knew the area was going to be changing. Parking would be difficult. Mm-hmm. And I said, why don't we move the gym back to Venice? So we moved it from 4,400 square feet to 6,600 square feet.
Wow.
And over time, we evolved. In 12 years, we were at 26,000.
Jeez, so wow.
I think our good fortune, our luck, you know, half of life, I would say, is luck.
Mm-hmm.
And because once you get it, you have to be prepared to act on it or be persistent and work hard. But we moved into that first bay, and then over time we added, you know, because the fitness industry was evolving. There were no bikes in the gym when we bought it.
Right, right.
There was no aerobic, no cardio. So as we added each room, we added more resistance machines. We added a aerobics room. We added 100 pieces of cardio ultimately or more.
Mm.
So we evolved along with the industry. So for about two or three decades, that 17,000 gym, when we were in the three bays, that was considered the ultimate gym. That was the Mecca. The model for hundreds of Gold's gyms.
Mm, okay.
We had a franchise model that when we ultimately sold out was at 15,000 square feet. So that was the minimum.
Okay.
Keep in mind the Gold gym you see in Pumping Iron was only 4,200 square feet. And yet that was the Mecca. That Arnold Schwarzenegger had to go from Graz, Austria to Venice, California to train because that was the gym.
Yeah.
I mean, hard to believe now because, you know, any place in America, any urban area, you've probably got a dozen choices, or at least before the pandemic.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy how it's changed. Yeah. So how long did you guys have it where you just owned the one bay? Because I've interviewed like Rick Valente, and they talk about how it was so great in the beginning when you just had that one room and everybody was training in there.
It took us 12 years to fill out the entire building. So we probably were adding a bay every two or three years.
Okay. All right.
So that first bay probably lasted maybe 3 years, I guess.
Okay, gotcha. So, yeah, like you said, the 80s, that was really the decade for bodybuilding, right? Because that's when the fitness boom really took off, and then more women started to get into it. Women's bodybuilding came along.
Well, Pete Kronkowski was dating Lisa Lyons.
Oh, was he? I didn't know that. Okay.
So she really started women's bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And we pioneered it. In fact, you know, we insisted our gyms be co-ed, which back then was not the case. So, you know, we actually got picketed in the South because of that. But no, we were.
Picketed in the South because you guys were co-ed?
Right.
Really? Wow.
I mean, people thought the women were going to get raped in the gym. And frankly, over the years, I mean, I've personally been involved in 37 Gold's gyms. You know, we had 704. I don't remember one case of a woman being assaulted in the gym.
Right, right.
Of course, people would say about Gold's Gym Venice, you know, the men are men and the women are too. Some of those women are, I mean, they were bigger than a lot of middleweight bodybuilders.
Wow, yeah.
What was the
atmosphere like back then, Ed, in the early?
Well, it was electric, and I guess it's still got some of that magic, but people would walk in there and they would tell me that they didn't really feel like working out, but when they got in there, they couldn't help it.
Right.
And Pete had his theory that, you know, the loud music helped, you know, caused energy to flow from individuals and actually helped them work out more. And of course, this is the day before, you know, headphones, iPods.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different world now. So, I mean, that's one of the big things that's changed is, you know, how people listen to music in a gym.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But that was the biggest headache back then, which is hard to imagine. But I would get calls from my gym manager saying, Ed, you know, they don't like the music we're playing. Can I, you know, what can we do? And we would have to have different radio stations at different times of the day to satisfy the different you know, moods during in a typical gym of a day. Yeah.
Huh. Now, had Joe Gold open up World's Gym down the street from you guys at that time?
Well, not right away. I mean, when he sold in 1970, he went back to the sea. And I think then he came back into L.A. and he regretted selling his gym, although not to us, obviously, because that wasn't the case. But he opened up a World Gym on Main Street in Santa Monica. And he kept it more like a private club. I mean, when he died in 2004, he had 600 members. Hmm. When we sold in 2004, we had 12,000.
Wow.
So his business could not have survived unless he had the franchise income coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
So he copied us. I mean, and actually he kept his fees pretty much the same. And we tried to meet regularly for lunch to talk about, you know, which owner our owners. Because if we would not renew someone for whatever reason, they might then try to become a World Gym or vice versa. So there was always this back and forth as to, you know, who were the people you might want to have join versus continue with your name.
Oh, okay. Were there a lot of big bodybuilders that went to both gyms that would go to World
Gym? Yeah, there were quite a few. Lee Priest, even though Lee was a house guest for his first 5 months in America, I think he was having trouble with some people in Gold's Gym Venice, so he went over to World Gym for a while. Lou Ferrigno went back and forth.
Yeah.
He was kind of I didn't mind that. You can get stale, you get bored. I would say a lot of our members had two or three memberships at different clubs.
Mm-hmm.
That was the time when people did that. No, I completely, and you've got to make the gym convenient. I mean, we were both close to each other. There was a powerhouse there too at one point. But no, it was, Arnold, of course, Arnold was loyal to Joe Gold because that's where he first came. But we had good relationship with Arnold and Maria he would poke his head in the gym a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he's keeping it alive now because he trains there.
Right.
And if it weren't for him, I think Google would have taken over the building already.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah. Huh.
What did you think of Joe Gold, when you got to meet
him? Well, I tell people if you looked up the word curmudgeon in the dictionary, there would be a picture of him.
Right.
He apparently had injured his back in Korea. So he was in a lot of pain.
Mm, okay. Yeah, he was real an old school bodybuilder, kind of like Vince Gironda too, right?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, he was a nice guy, but very opinionated, strong opinions, and
yeah.
Well, a good example is I ran into we would go to Arnold's restaurant a lot for business lunches. It was called Chotsey's.
Uh huh.
It was in the building he owned on Main Street. And one day, there was a period, 1991, 92, when Arnold owned a World Gym for 2 years. And he said to me, Ed, how come your gym is so busy and mine is empty? Or not empty, but not so busy.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's a stereo system. And Joe Gold did not, he thought I was joking. Arnold laughed. But, Joe Gold would not allow any music in the gym.
Right.
So it was like a church. And so, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm very self-conscious when I drop a weight or make noise.
Yeah.
So having that music to mask that is something I like, and I think a lot of people do. So, that was a big difference. It was like a church in there, or
That's what I heard. It was like it depended on what kind of personality you had. Like Mike Christian, he wanted more of the rock and roll, and he wanted more of the high energy, so he would go to Gold's. Or other guys would go to Worlds, all depended on, what kind of personality you had, what kind of atmosphere you wanted. All right. And our final clip was another one, a very popular guest that I had, John Little. So we interviewed John last year about his relationship with Mike Mentzer. And we also interviewed him just recently, about a month ago, because it was the 20th anniversary of Mike Mentzer's passing, who died in 2001 at the age of 50, I believe. John was a very interesting guest. Again, this podcast got a lot of views. A lot of people were really interested in Mike Mentzer still. And John was also an expert on Bruce Lee.
He has done several movies on him. He produced several movies about Bruce Lee. He wrote a lot of books about Bruce Lee. So I asked him about some of the things about Bruce Lee, like his training, his weight training, how powerful he was, and if he was really as good as the legend says that Bruce Lee was.
Talk a little bit about Bruce Lee. And you know what's really interesting when you look at Bruce Lee's short life, how much his physique improved so much, like when he was in Kato, and then yeah. when he got into the martial arts movies that he made in Hong Kong, especially Enter the Dragon, of course, but how his physique yeah. improved so much. So do you think that was a direct result of him being interested in bodybuilding and buying the magazines and, you know, maybe doing
art? Oh, yeah, he'd started buying the magazines in the mid to late 60s. Strength and Health, Muscular Development,
yeah,
Joe's magazines. And he clipped out articles by, you know, training articles, Iron Man. And he had them in, a gray folder. And
really?
I went through it once and made a list of what all the articles were. But, yeah, he was in with both feet in bodybuilding. He thought bodybuilding was great, you know. And
wow.
It was never his goal, nor did he have the genetics to be huge.
Yeah.
But because I remember he was and another student of his were walking down in Santa Monica by the dungeon, the old gym they called the dungeon down there. And some huge guy came out. I don't know who it was. Might have been Dave Draper.
Yeah.
And
one on the beach, right, on Santa Monica Beach.
Yeah. And the guy said, whoa, who see the size of that guy, Bruce? But he said, yeah, you know, but, you know, is he powerful? Meaning, can you use that quickly?
Yeah.
So his big thing was getting the muscles stronger, but to use them in a practical way. I think the muscular development, he was proud of his physique, no question about it, but that was almost a side effect of his objective. He had tremendous lats, but he had those since he was a teenager. You know, again, genetics. Tiny waist. His forearms were bigger than his biceps by about 1 or 2 inches.
Wow.
His abs were developed. There wasn't just that there was no body fat there and you could see his abs. There actually were, you talk about fiber density, he had the ridges.
Yeah.
Same with his pecs. He had pretty good pecs too.
Yeah.
And then what happened when he went to Hong Kong was the humidity sweat out all the water, all the interstitial water, and he wasn't eating as much. So he was like dieting. And then by the time Enter the Dragon rolled around, it was like a skinned cat.
You know? Yeah.
Never seen that kind of definition before.
Right.
But he never, I think it is the most he weighed when he was, you know, taking his Bob Hoffman protein powder and pumping the iron 3 days a week. He was about 145.
Yeah.
By the time he made Enter the Dragon, because of the humidity and the choreography and all of this stuff, he was 120.
Wow, so, 120.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
5'7" and a half, 120 pounds.
Jeez.
But insane power. Like James Coburn, I remember he and I were in a room waiting to go on. They were doing a documentary on Bruce, and they were interviewing, you know, different people that were there. I think Van Williams from the Green Hornet was there.
Yeah.
And him and myself, because I'd written a book, and we were talking. Or actually, we were talking, but not about that. When he went on camera, James Coburn revealed an anecdote where he said Bruce had an 85-pound Everlast canvas punching bag hung in the backyard. Hung it in Coburn's backyard. He said, this is for you to work out on. And he said, I'll break it in for you. And he said, Bruce hit it with a sidekick without running, just sidekick. He said, ripped a hole in the bag that big. He said, the stuffing came out of it and it snapped the chain that was holding the bag.
Holy
the bag went
shit.
Into the yard. And he studied mechanics a lot. Like he was, if you watch and analyze his movement, it's all the physics behind it. A lot of hip, you know, generating power into stuff he did. Even his 1-inch punch.
Yeah.
It all comes from the hips and the legs.
Yeah. You know?
But it's, he was phenomenally fast. And unlike a lot of our heroes and movie star action heroes, he was the real deal.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, he was a better fighter in real life than he was in his movies.
Wow.
So he was everything you thought he was.
Yeah.
I've spoken to people that saw him fight for real and that it saw him spar good fighters. And they all said we couldn't touch him. He was just so fast. I remember there was a fellow that worked in Black Belt Magazine's warehouse. I want to say his name was Mark Wong. And we got to be friends. And one day we got to talking. I said, oh, you worked at Black Belt. I said, Bruce Lee used to go there all the time. You must have seen him. He goes, oh, yeah. Saw him a lot. I said, do you remember anything about him? He goes, yeah, a couple things. He goes, one, he said he was skinny. He said he looked skinny. And he was cocky. He seemed cocky to me. He said, now I grew up in East L.A. He said, and I was in street gangs and all that stuff. And we were, you know, we fought a lot. So, you know, the fact that he was Kato didn't impress me. And I guess when Bruce left, Mark spoke to the owner of the magazine, a guy by the name of Mito Uehara.
Yeah.
And told him his thoughts. You know, what's this skinny guy doing back here? And Mito said, well, you don't think he can fight? And he said, no. He goes, you know, one kick, the guy'd blow away, basically. You know? And he said, well, what do you, are you a fighter? He goes, yeah, I box and I do this. He goes, oh, okay. So anyway, I guess 3 or 4 days pass and Bruce walks back into the warehouse where this guy is. And he says, hey, I understand you're a boxer. And he goes, yeah. He goes, well, let's box. You know, come on, let's see what you can do. And he said Bruce was 15 feet away from him. He said he was in, slapped him in the head, was back out in 15 feet before the guy knew what happened. Okay, let's do that again. You know, Bruce did it again. Bang, back. And then Bruce said, well, listen, you don't seem to be much of a boxer. He said, what? he said, let's see a kick. So he had an air shield and the guy kicked it. And Bruce said, well, that's okay. He goes, here, hold this. And air shields like those old football ones.
You know? That he used
that. The guy said, same thing. No run, no nothing. He said, Bruce Lee kicked me. He said, I went 25 feet back. He said, I've been hit by a car before. He said, and this hurt more than that. Jeez. So it was, I mean, he was a phenom. He was a generational talent that just you don't see very often.
Yeah.
Super smart, super fit.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a time I owned his Marcy circuit trainer, the machine that he had imported to Hong Kong. It was like a universal machine, multi-station unit.
Uh-huh.
And he used to train on it. So that was kind of cool when I used to work out on that. You know,
yeah.
It was Bruce's. But
anyway,
I don't own that anymore. But it was he was into that. And Walter Marcian, who owned Marcy Equipment, had designed that. And again, the bodybuilding connection. You know, the Marcy Equipment was all over gyms back in the day. So Bruce was plugged into that.
Wow, that's awesome. When I just watched that Last Dance, the documentary about Michael Jordan and the Bulls. And, you know, when I was watching that, I was thinking, you know, because Michael Jordan was a really hard worker and he really wanted to win. He had a lot of desire. But I was thinking how much of his success was due to his genetics, his natural ability to be a good basketball player, and how much was due to his hard work. And I always thought that about Bruce Lee, too, because I know Bruce Lee was, like, totally dedicated. I remember he had that huge library of books. And like you said, he would study all these different fighting styles. He would run the films backwards and he would study the mechanics, like you said, and things like that. And his training was like so crazy. But you wonder like how much of his speed and stuff was genetic, his reflexes and things, you know?
I think a lot of it, it's like most things, you know, from eye color to height to skin pigmentation to athletic aptitude, it's all genetic. Or at least it's a huge component.
Yeah.
But a lot of people can have the genetic gift, but they don't know it, and they don't go into an activity that allows it to express itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just kind of diminishes and atrophies, and you never hear about it.
Yeah.
Other people, for some reason, get attracted to a sport that they are genetically wired to be amazing at.
Yeah.
And when they train, they get even more amazing at it.
Yeah.
And I think that was Bruce Lee. I mean, his speed... I mean, there's no secret to his training methods. They've been out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen anyone duplicate his speed yet.
Right.
So, I mean, Bruce would have been slower if he didn't train the way he did, but he'd still be ridiculously fast.
Yeah.
But when that's married with resistance training, so you have a stronger, more powerful strike,
right?
It's almost unfathomable. I remember talking to a Pan Am gold medalist in judo, who was also a third or fourth dan in Shotokan karate. And his name is Hayward Nishioka, and worked at Cal State for a while, taught there, but phenomenal judo man, like top of the heap. And you know, most martial artists, when you talk about Bruce, they downplay his attributes because they feel they don't look as good by comparison. So if they diminish Bruce, you know, what you're left with is
the real deal.
So Hayward didn't have an ego. He was awesome that way. I mean, he won enough championships. He didn't need to, you know, concoct an image for himself. But I said, what was it like with Bruce? He said, well, sparring with him, he goes, was ridiculous because you couldn't do anything. He said, you know, I'm high up there in judo. I'm high up there in karate. He said, he said it was like he was psychic. He said he knew what I was going to do before I did it, and he would shut me down. Mm. And he'd be in and he'd be out like he was with the guy in the warehouse, and I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
He said he was so fast. And the other thing was, he said, he hit me with this 1-inch punch. And he said, and I'm thinking as I'm flying backwards 15 feet into a wall and sliding down the wall, he goes, I'm a Pan Am gold medal. How the hell is this happening? And he said, you know, I got so pissed off and frustrated sparring with him or trying to spar with him. I said, yeah, Bruce, I'm not doing this. Bruce said, what's up? And he said, yeah, I can't do anything. This is ridiculous. He said, what? He goes, you know, my game is judo. He said, you know, I'm on the ground. Arm bars, locks, chokes. He goes, what would you do if I just lay down on the ground, waited for you? He said, well, I wouldn't do anything. He said, but don't get up. You know? So it may be true that, you know, 80% of the fights end up on the ground, but it's also true 100% of them start standing up. So Bruce had a pretty good stand-up game. And he actually wasn't bad in grappling, but his big thing was it should be over quickly.
Yeah.
Like you don't want to drag this out because that's when things can go wrong that you didn't plan for.
Right, right.
And so he was lightning fast, but he also had power with the speed, which is just rare, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
One of his early students, Jesse Glover, told me that, I forget what the timing was, but they timed him and it was like so quick. It was in hundreds and hundreds of a second for a strike. And he'd hit a catcher's mask and it was caved in when he hit it. At that speed, bam. So he said at that point, he said, we knew that if Bruce actually punched someone, he would kill him.
Hmm.
He said, that's, you know, everyone talks about his kicks. He said, but man, he said, if Bruce punched you, it would have been lights. You would have been dead. You know,
so, yeah.
Not to mention, you know, push-ups on thumbs only.
Phenomenal.
One finger of one arm. Guy's body awareness was off the charts.
Yeah. And even his ab exercises where he's raising his whole body up and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, where he did that almost look like a bridge with his legs, those leg raises. Yeah. Yeah, no, he was in phenomenal condition.
Yeah. Yeah, what a phenomenon. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed these clips from our anniversary show as much as I did. I really love going back and listening to some of these old shows that we did. We had some great guests. So we will do it one more time next week where we'll have part 3 of our 4-year anniversary. A lot of shows to go over, so I thought I would make this a several parter instead of just doing it on one show. All right, I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sticking with the Bodybuilding Legends podcast every week to sponsor the show. I appreciate you guys. I also appreciate all our Patreon sponsors who are supporting the show each month with their donations. And like I said, if you want to be a part of that Patreon group, you can just go to the Bodybuilding Legends show website. And in the upper right-hand corner, you can just click on that link and be a Patreon donor yourself. All right, guys, I appreciate anybody who supports us with that. And if you want to email me about these shows or any other guests that you may have in mind, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, so here is our article for the week. It's called Another Gold-Crusted Olympia Under His Belt, Mr. Serendipity Goes His Alchemic Way Forward by Rick Wayne, Mr. World. And this is from the February 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And this was the magazine that covered the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest. All right. It says he's sitting mere inches from me on the other side of my turning tape recorder, his brown suede sports jacket pale in comparison with the deep mahogany of his South of France suntan. You get the ego-bruising feeling that if the man were somehow pushed into a New York cesspit, he'd come up smiling, smelling of Chanel No. 5, gold dripping from every discernible orifice. Everything he touches seemingly alchemizes into gold,
King Midas was strictly Little League compared with the man. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who in some circles is God, doubtless because of his uncanny proclivity for popping up here, there, and boudoirs everywhere, from Hoboken to Istanbul, apparently at the same time, is back in sunny Los Angeles after an absence of nearly 3 weeks. Once again, is available for his ritual monthly interview with Muscle Builder. It is the moment I live for, the very essence of my weekly existence, you might say, depending on your own sense of respect in the neonized face of truth. Word was that Arnold had cleverly talked his way into a fantastic tour of Israel, all expenses paid, naturally, he knows no other way, sanguineous carpets all the way. So our interview begins this way. Pray tell, I say, what is this I hear about you hobnobbing in Israel with gold in my ear? I had no idea the lady was your fantasy focus. He chuckled that wicked Schwarzenegger chuckle that has been known to melt marrows among the female habitues of South of Venice Beach on occasion, brushed an errant graying curl from his face, cradled his chin in an enormous right paw. Oh, yeah, that, he said finally, as if making it with gold in my ear is just about as mundane as a visit to a porno palace on Santa Monica Boulevard. You heard about that, huh? Uh-huh. Who told you? Who cares? Some Venice Beachhead case, maybe. You shouldn't talk about Artie Zeller like that, he scolded in his best Austrian schoolmaster voice, and then cracked up delayed action style over his own poor gag. At last, he recovers to say, yeah, I was at this press conference in Cannes. I was out there doing some promo work on the movie, you know, Pumping Iron. Question and answers with reporters from everywhere, that sort of thing. Well, anyway, someone wanted to know what my future plans were, and I said I'd like to take a short break from work and do a little traveling for a few weeks. Then another reporter asked me where I'd like to go. Well, the first country that popped into my head was Israel. Israel, he says. Why Israel? I told him I didn't really know why, that maybe I was fascinated with Israel, that I'd be fascinated by a country that is as much in the news. The reporter told me something might well be arranged to make my visit an enjoyable one. Well, anyway, I finally returned to Los Angeles, and only a few days later, I received this letter from the government of Israel. It turned out that the reporter in Cannes, who was talked about arranging things, was responsible for Israel's international public relations. The letter told me that each year, the government of Israel invites a Hollywood personality to their country, and it would be nice if I would come this year. They enclose round-trip tickets, by the way. I wrote back saying I would be happy to travel to Israel on three conditions. Conditions, I echoed. Naturally, I told them that I would visit Israel if they would arrange for a meeting with gold in my ear, a tank that I could drive, and what was the third now? Hey, I've forgotten. They agreed, and that's how come I was in Israel until yesterday. So how was the old lady? I can't really say, he laughed. I didn't get to meet her after all. She was tied up with all kinds of political things while I was there, and although she agreed to meet me a day later, it didn't work out. You see, I had to fly back to Los Angeles. Business appointments. While in Israel, Arnold judged a bodybuilding contest, visited schools, participated in at least three talk shows, kissed pretty girls, the sort of thing that's commonplace for him in L.A. and Germany and London and Paris and the Kalahari Desert. And I have no doubt in my mind that he took at least one opportunity to suggest to his female host on TV Israel that he'd be the most amenable to removing his shirt on camera on condition that she led the way by discarding her own blouse, just as he's done so many times before, as he intimated to Lynn Gordon in Toronto only a few weeks ago during a televised interview. What nerve. With the Mr. Olympia contest just a few weeks off, I asked Arnold the promoter how things were going. You mean coming, don't you? He said, mischief or light in his blue eyes. I can tell you the tickets to the show have all disappeared, just a few left over for the prejudging. Still more proof that the man has absolutely no need of rabbit feet, lucky dollars, or any other such good luck charms. He is a walking wishing well. Okay, then, I say, let's talk about your bit in We Magazine. Why? On account of I'm supposed to ask the questions, remember? There are a few things you told the magazine in your interview that I could do with a little clearing up. Like what, for instance? Like all the talk about marijuana you smoke, for instance? Hey, I've been getting all kinds of letters from guys who want to know if it's good to smoke joints for definition. Let me make it perfectly clear. The face, the fingers, they're actually reminiscent of the fallen president. Joints and bodybuilding do not make the best music together. Seriously, I received a lot of letters because of the We interview. Most very favorable, but there have been some negative ones too.
Let's talk about the negative ones. Well, the very conservative health fanatics don't like what I had to say about smoking marijuana. They didn't like me saying people who go crazy with a health kick are really quite full of shit. Of course, I was misquoted as saying people who train for health are full of shit. I didn't actually say that, naturally. Are you worried that by your stories in magazines such as We, you might be misleading youngsters, people who look upon you as some kind of god, young 12 and 13-year-old boys and so on? Aren't you worried that they might take to smoking marijuana because you claim in the interview that you do? No, I don't think so. I think the parents of those kids might feel that way about some of the things I say and do because they want nice examples for their kids. And, well, they don't think what I said in We adds up to the best next best thing to a nice example. I mean, sometimes I use four-letter words. That sort of thing brings some parents out in a nervous rash. But generally, there hasn't been much bad feeling about the We thing. He was having a bad time explaining away his magazine persona. When you get down to it, he rationalized, most parents in America get stoned anyway. So where do they come off talking about my lifestyle? Let them be the nice examples for their kids to emulate. Today, enlightened people know marijuana does not cause illness, is no threat to good health, is not addictive. It's merely as evil as alcohol, for example. Of course, there are people who'd like for the obverse side of my coin to show this epitome of all things virtuous. Hey, I'm not a hypocrite. I won't pretend I don't go for girls or smoke a little marijuana and drink a bit. I can't live with the image that all I do is lift barbells and swallow protein pills all day. Who needs this shit? Well, anyways, we're into mid-October. The 1977 Mr. Olympia has gone down heavy. Frank Zane really has made the year his own. Waller is somewhat blue in the face, and Robbie somewhere in Europe drowning his sorrows to the beautiful tune of tinkling coins and who knows what else. Billy Grant is in hibernation, and Arnold is back at my desk again, his massive thighs and calves beaming almost expansively as his contented face. So how did it go, I say, I, who did not make the show after all. It was the greatest thing ever, he says, not without some excitement in his baritone. I have received letters from about 7 of the competitors in the 2 contests, and a number of the delegates also wrote to say how much they enjoyed the International and the Olympia. Of course, there were a couple grumbles concerning the contest results, but you expect that, right? Did he have any serious problems organizing the shows? None at all. I mean, there were a number of little worries on the part of the contestants that I had to deal with, but all in all, everything went according to plan. The way Arnold puts it, Jim Lorimer, my partner, and I started planning the 1977 contest one day after the Mr. Olympia 1976. People don't realize the amount of work that goes into putting on the Olympia. First, you have to secure the theater. Then there's the matter of the cash prizes, money that has to be put aside no matter what happens in the last analysis. I mean, even if the show turned out to be a financial flop, we'd still have to produce the bread to pay out as cash prizes. We take a big chance. There's the matter of dealing with such things as printing, canvassing, and preparing advertisements for the program, transportation requirements for competitors from all over the United States and elsewhere. It's a big job. People tend to forget it was Jim Lorimer who first put weightlifting on television, on Wide World of Sports. What a guy. He shuns the limelight. You won't see him rushing to meet the press and dishing out trophies and all that stuff. He says talk is cheap. Action is what counts. And he lives by that credo. No, there were no problems tied with organizing the International and the Olympia. Just a lot of bloody hard work. I did a lot of traveling. Jim Lorimer did a lot of sweating, but then you should also remember the man is a genius. He's proven himself over and over as a promoter in Columbus. He has respect there because he has always delivered. Which brought me to the question, why Columbus? Why won't you take the Olympia to another city? Only this morning I was talking to Tommy Minicello on the phone. He said, Arnold, you have the greatest muscle contest in the world. You have the best venue, the best atmosphere. A whole lot of chemistry comes together. You can't beat what you've got in Columbus. And he's right, of course. Everybody says the same, even though I have to admit that in the beginning, it was considered a strange venue for a contest such as the Olympia. You have to remember, our venue is the center of America, basically. It's just 1,000 miles from New York, 1,800 miles from California, close to Florida, and not that far for the Europeans to come. I've had letters from hundreds of spectators telling me that the greatest thing about the Olympia is that they no longer have to travel 3,000 miles to see it. Also, on the plus side, we have the support of the city. The mayor backs us. Sponsors support us as well. We have a national sponsor who wants it in Columbus because it generates business. It's perfect. Anyway, the contests have been the most successful. Why kick a good thing? As an afterthought, he added, "Of course, my biggest asset in that city is Jim Lorimer. If you want to put on a contest anywhere, be sure that you have a man living in the city that you choose as your venue." Arnold's already planning the Mr. Olympia in 1978. Our various committees have sat and talked. We meet very soon to put up a budget, and then the real work starts all over again, he said. We have applied for the same theater. We wanted it at the time when football won't interfere with our attendance figures. A number of points must be considered before an actual show date can be announced. Meanwhile, all the other facets are in motion. We'll have a still greater contest next year, and we plan on an even bigger cash prize. This year, the figure was $15,000. Is there the remotest chance that Olympia fans might see Arnold in posing trunks again? This is a surprise treat, I said. His face turned a rock. Not a chance in the world, he insisted. My treat is to present yet another fantastic contest. This time there'll be a live orchestra, all the trimmings, and there'll be bigger prizes. We'll also try to bring in more competitors for the Olympia contest, but nobody will see Arnold under the lights again. Meanwhile, he looks magnificent, even for Schwarzenegger. Is there anything you did in your bodybuilding career that other guys don't do that you consider an important part or factor in your success? Hey, it's the interview time, right? Yes, he smiled. I've always considered the mind. By that, I mean the attitude to training of the very greatest importance. Look, I do cheat curls the same way that Pearl does them and Franco and Zane and everyone else does them. But it's the way I engage my mind during the exercise that makes it all the difference. It would be right on target to say that I'm not the only one who is into this mind muscle training. Zane and Franco have been into that for a while now. We all practically will ourselves back into shape. I can almost command a muscle to grow or pump up. The majority of bodybuilders of my acquaintance are not yet into that phase. There was another factor. I used a wide variety of exercises for the various body parts, he said. Most bodybuilders are scared shitless by anything new. I enjoyed putting new exercise combinations together, enjoyed experimenting. It seems to me that guys are wary of new ground. Anyway, how do you expect to develop muscles through their fullest range, to their full potential, if you don't do every possible exercise for the different areas? How indeed. So it turns out that Arnold won't be back, not in posing trunks anyway, but still it looks like fair weather all the way, for the boy promises to be with us a long time to come, if only as bodybuilding's number one ambassador, promoter, and frontman, which can't be all bad when you get to thinking about it. All right. Great article by Rick Wayne. And, of course, we know that Arnold did come back in 1980 to compete in the Mr. Olympia, but great perspective from 1977 when he was really into promoting, and that was his second Mr. Olympia that he did with Jim Lorimer. And, of course, they went on to have an unbelievable career that is still going on today in 2021. The Arnold Classic is scheduled for September this year, and Jim Lorimer, thankfully, is still with us in his 90s, and Arnold is 75 this year, and he is still promoting it as well. So, absolutely amazing. Great story, great team, and they really have promoted bodybuilding magnificently. All right, guys, that's all we got for this week's edition of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Join us next week when we will have our last part three of our four-year anniversary. Stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.